The Gerontinus brings down a fascinating event. Abba Chilkia, who was the grandson of Chuni HaMagal. Abba Chilkia was a tremendous individual. He was the person that Chazal went to when they needed trouble, when they needed help, when they were in trouble. And much like Chuni HaMagal was the person that Klai Yisrael turned to, so too was his grandson Abba Chilkia. And the Gemara tells us that whenever the Klai Yisrael needed rain, they would send messengers to Abba Chilkia. He would daven and it would rain. He became known as effectively the rain maker. And keep in mind that this was Eretz Yisrael at a time where if there wasn't rain, there was famine, there was death. And he was a man of such stature that he alone could do what the rest of the Jewish nation couldn't do. He would daven to Hashem, and in fact, Hashem would listen. And he did this on a regular basis. The Gemara tells us at one time, in fact, there was a drought, there was no rain, and the Chachamim sent a pair of Talmidei Chachamim to Abba Chilkia to ask him to daven. This pair went to his house, and when they got to his house, he wasn't there. They quickly found out that he was in the field, and a number of interesting things happened. But when this pair of Talmidei Chachamim went to the field, and they watched from a distance Abba Chilkia working, they waited, and before he left the field, his wife, Abba Chilkia's wife, came out adorned, very beautifully dressed, wearing jewelry. And when the Chachamim went over to Abba Chilkia, initially he didn't respond. They followed him back. He and his wife back to his house. And when he got to his house, he offered these Talmidei Chachamim some food to eat. He sat them down at a table, and he said to his wife, "Come with me." And he said to his wife, "I know why these Chachamim have come. They've come to ask me to daven. But why should it be that people should have to be machzik tov to Abba Chilkia? Let us go to the roof. Let us daven. And maybe Hashem will answer and they won't have to ask for it." Kahava, he and his wife went to the roof. He stood in one corner. She stood in her corner. And he started davening. It wasn't long before the rain clouds began gathering, first on her side, and then later on his, and then they both came down. They sat down to join these Talmidei Chachamim, and Abba Chilkia said, "What could I do for you? Why did you come?" They said, "We came because we wanted to ask you to intercede, to ask Hashem to make it rain." Says Abba Chilkia, "Oh, Baruch Hashem, you're not meshubad, you don't owe anything to Abba Chilkia, because you see it's going to rain without me." This pair of Talmidei Chachamim said to Abba Chilkia, "We know very well that it's going to rain because of you. And we appreciate that. But we have some questions that we want to ask you." And they asked a number of questions about what he did in the field, what he did on the way back. And one of the questions that they asked is, "Why is it that your wife went out to greet you fully adorned, beautifully attired, wearing jewelry, wearing a full dress up?" And he said these words. He said, "Kidei shelo etein einai b'isha acheres, in order that I not place my eye on another woman, that I shouldn't look at other women, I asked my wife to do this." Apparently it was a regular practice. He asked his wife to do this so he should have eyes for his wife and his wife alone. And let's focus on this Gemara for a minute. And let's ask the obvious question. We're dealing with a man who is leagues above any human being we've ever met. We're dealing with a man who the Chachamim understand to be in a league bifnei atzmo. He's a man of Kedusha v'tahara, a man of tremendous, tremendous madrega, that he alone can do that which no one else can do in his generation. Wouldn't you imagine that such a person would have full self-control? Such a person wouldn't need tachbulos, wouldn't need strategies, not to have a roving eye. The man was dovik b'Hashem. But number two, I don't know how wise the strategy is. After all, what did he do? He asked his wife to get all dressed up so he should look at her. It sounds like what he was doing was going from the frying pan into the fire, increasing whatever the problem of desire might have been. And the question is, what was he doing and what's pshat in this Gemara? And to understand pshat in this Gemara, I'd like to share with you an interesting concept that the Rambam tells us. The Rambam gives us a pure, perfect formula for Shalom Bayis. It's a formula that's so simple and so obvious and will work guaranteed. Says the Rambam in Hilchos Ishus, Savu Chachamim, our Chachamim commanded a husband, L'chabed is ishto yoseh migufo, to honor his wife more than he does himself. Uli ahavo kigufo, and to love her as he does himself. V'chein, so too, says the Rambam, Sivu Chachamim, Chazal obligated a woman. Chazal obligated a woman to honor her husband yoseh midai, to honor him exceedingly, to have almost an ema and a yira, almost an awe of her husband, almost as if he's a prince or a king, to obey his every wishes and every desires. And says the Rambam, if a couple will do this, if he will honor his wife more than himself and love her as himself, if she will treat her husband with honor, yoseh midai, says the Rambam, their being together, their family, their existence will be na'e u'meshubach, beautiful and wonderful. And it is a very simple formula, a very obvious formula, and you'd imagine that shalom bayis would be the simplest thing in the world. Husband, all you have to do is treat her with more honor than yourself. Lover is yourself. Wife, all you have to do is treat him with exceeding honor, and we have shalom bayis, peace, and everything's beautiful. So what's the problem? Why there's so many issues? Why there's so many divorces? Why there's so much machlokas? Why is there so much screaming and yelling and ranting and raving going on? The Rambam gave us a formula, and it's obvious. And I'd like to share with you that it is very simple when you are chassan and kala. When the kala walks in the room, oh, the chassan looks, and his eyes, he obviously respects her more than himself, loves her, at least infatuated, as much as himself. And the kala, when the chassan walks in, what's a Shabbos, I had a couple over, they're engaged, and they stayed for a little while, they stayed for Avdullah. When we passed around the besamim, she wouldn't take the besamim before she gave it to her chassan. That was impressive, but it was the next stage. I brought him into my office to speak, and they were sitting down, and after a while I wanted to speak to her alone, so I asked him to step out. I was speaking to her for a few minutes, and then he came back in. As he walks in, she stands up. Wow. I mean, he's about 25 years old. I mean, we're not talking, you know, the Rosh Bahag. I mean, right? She stands up. And it's obvious that the chassan and kala have the formula down pat. He respects her, and she respects him, and everything's great. So what's the problem? The problem is that in real life, it doesn't quite work that way. And in real life, things start to disintegrate. The respect starts to disappear. And before you know it, the couple, as much as they started out on a path of na'a v'shevach, a beautiful life together, oftentimes are very, very far away. But I'd like to share with you that if we carefully pay attention to exactly what the Rambam's saying, there is a very deep understanding that he shares with us. And through Chazal, I think we could get an eye glimpse into how it can be that one can actually solve many of the problems and live that type of existence. Let me share with you one beginning point. Why did Chazal obligate her to treat him with honor, yoseh midai? Doesn't make sense. The man has to treat his wife with more honor than he does himself. Okay, I got that. But the woman has to look at her husband as if he's a king, a prince. Whatever his wishes are, she should pine away to do them with exceeding honor. Why did Chazal obligate a woman to treat her husband with such respect, with such honor? And if you'd like to understand the answer to that question, it's predicated on understanding a basic difference between men and women. Men and women have almost nothing in common. They're different in temperament, in nature, they're different in outlook, they're different in interests. They're so different that you would think that they come from different planets, different orbits, different people for sure. Let me share with you an example. When my daughter was in 11th grade, she said to me one day that two of her friends didn't come to school that day. I said, why not? She said, well, they were having a DMC. I said, what? Well, they were up late last night having a DMC, so they didn't come to school. I got a little concerned. What's a DMC? So she said, Abba, you don't know? No. a DMC, a deep, meaningful conversation. And they were up late last night having a deep, meaningful conversation. I got to sleep at 3 o'clock, so I didn't come to school that next day. I taught high school boys for 15 years. I don't think I ever saw two guys sharing their emotions and giving each other back and forth support. And never. Women need relationships. Women need friends. Women create on a constant basis very real relationships. And if you'd like to see this in action, just begin at the very, very early stages. Go to a schoolyard, and you'll see the differences between boys and girls surface and first grade, second grade for sure. And you'll see the boys playing in large groups, and the girls usually play in small little groups. And the boys are usually playing a game where one's the winner and another one's the loser. The girls playing all kinds of different games. No winners, no losers, just more of who's playing with who, who's the best friend, maybe telling some secrets. In the boys' world, the boys play to dominate. In the girls' world, they don't play to dominate. In the boys' world, if you're the best ball player, you're considered a status person. You might even be considered a most chashuv guy because you play ball well. In the girls' world, that doesn't exist. You see, men and women from their very earliest ages are very different in their emotional needs. Women need social connections, they need relationships, they need that connectivity. And if you'd like to see this really in action, go to a schoolyard and watch what happens when a child gets hurt. If it's boys playing, the assumption is that if the kid has fallen and hurt himself, he'll get out of the way so the game can go on. Come on, what are you, crybaby? You're stopping the game. And if a girl is playing amongst girls and she falls, the game stops. Oh, are you okay? Are you all right? And there's a very real difference in their relationships, and those differences continue and become more extreme. Women need relationships, and the relationships that they form are very different than men do. Women form peer-to-peer relationships. That means equals. In fact, it's very difficult for a woman who gets a position of power. She's usually uncomfortable. Don't call me head nurse, maybe lead nurse, team leader. A woman often is uncomfortable with position, with being over people, because she likes to be a peer. Don't call me aunt. Call me by my first name. Come on. It's too formal. Men have no problem with that. As a matter of fact, almost every male relationship is hierarchical. There's a teacher and a student, an expert and a novice. There's always a hierarchy, and in almost every male relationship, there's one who's above and one who's below. And this surfaces in a very interesting way. Women support each other, women nurture each other, and when men and women get married, something interesting happens. And I'll share with you what that is. When I was ready to publish the first Shmooze on the Parsha book, I needed it to be copy edited. My mother-in-law at the time was working full-time, but she has a very sharp eye. So I asked her if she could do it for me, and she agreed, and she did an excellent job. When she was finished and was about ready to go to press, I was writing an acknowledgement part, and I wanted to thank her for, you know, for doing the editing, and I sort of had a Yetzirah. I was going to write in it the following line. I was going to write, I would thank my mother-in-law for copy editing the book, but there's nothing that gives a mother-in-law more joy than correcting her son-in-law, so I don't have to thank her. Now, I didn't write it. I didn't think it was respectful. I didn't write it. Years later, my wife told my mother-in-law about it. She said, you should have written it. It was very funny. And bottom line is, I didn't write it. But I'd like to share with you that mother-in-laws get into a lot of trouble for exactly that reason. You know why? A woman by nature is nurturing. A woman by nature is a caregiver. Her daughter comes home with a fellow. Excellent guy. Great guy. The mother-in-law is impressed. What a great guy. Wow, this my land, that my. He's a great guy. But like everybody could do, he could be even better. And the mother-in-law, in her nurturing, giving way, tries to do whatever she can to show her son-in-law how welcome he is and how much accepted he is. So she does everything she can to nurture him and make him even better. And she offers all types of unsolicited, unasked for advice. Now, gentlemen, in a guy's world, if you go over to a man and say, you could do this much better if you do this. you'd do much better if you would be doing this and this. Those are fighting words, meaning to say it's rude. It's obnoxious. What are you, above me? What am I, my master? You're standing over me, boss, telling me how to do things? If I needed advice, I would have asked you. I didn't need advice, and I didn't ask you. Please don't offer your advice. I know a Rav, a Choshev Talmud Chacham, people call him Mi'arba Kanfos Aretz. From all over the world, people call him for his advice. And he said to me at his own table, he will not offer his children advice. If they ask me, I'll gladly tell them, but I'm not offering unsolicited advice. Because in a man's world, offering unsolicited advice is rude. But mother-in-laws don't recognize that. They think it's a woman's world, which is how they're used to working. And women to women are always offering support and advice. And when one woman offers another woman advice, the other woman says, thank you very much. Because they're peers. Because there's no ego involved. It's not hierarchical. It's even. And there's no hurt egos. And as a result, they're able to take it very well. Now, if you told me that mother-in-laws get into trouble, it's not that big of a deal. The problem becomes much more profound in the marriage itself. You see, I believe it's true that every kala comes into the marriage with a 10-point program. 10-point program, how she's going to improve her chasan. A great guy, excellent, wonderful, but, you know, listen, first thing that's going to go with her shoes, and that suit, the ties, and the on-time business, and she has a plan. And as she's walking down to the chuppah, she's saying to herself, he's great, and I'm going to make him even greater. Okay, wonderful. They get married. Shav Bruch is over, and she starts on her home improvement policy. First day after Shav Bruch is, she mentions, out of goodness, out of nurturing, out of love, you know, if you put your svarim in order, I bet you'd learn even more. You wouldn't have to look for him. And oddly enough, he doesn't respond with appreciation. He gets kind of like, thank you. That's strange. And then a little bit later, she gives another one of her pearls of good advice. You know, if you'd leave 10 minutes before the meeting, you'd be on time. You really should do that. And again, oddly enough, he's not all warm and fuzzy and receptive. He's kind of cold. And it goes on, and it gets worse and worse. And she can't figure him out. She's showing him how much she cares. And she's showing him clearly how much she's concerned for his good. And not only doesn't he reciprocate, he gets cold and starts getting nasty and snooty. What's wrong with this guy? Something's wrong with him. Would you like to know what's wrong with him? He has a male ego. You see, a woman is a tsanua. Tsnius is not about necklines and how long the sleeves are. Tsnius is a midah of modesty, humility. As in, I'm uncomfortable when other people look at me. I'm uncomfortable being the center of attention. I'm uncomfortable being in the limelight. Tsnius is a midah of humbleness, and it's a midah of exactly that, of modesty. And a woman by nature is a tsanua. She's uncomfortable when people stare at her. She's uncomfortable when she's in the limelight. And those women who, you know, meet all the criteria down to the wrist and down to the ankle, but the clothing is tight or loud or very, very noticeable, they're not only not understanding what tsnius is, they're causing a internal disharmony. You see, a woman by nature wants to be modest. And when she walks into the wedding and all eyes turn, wow, you look great, wow, where'd you get that dress? Wow, wow, wow. There's a part of her that says, this is great. Look at all this attention, everyone looking at me, and everyone's, this is unbelievable. And there's another part of her that says, ugh, why is everybody looking at me? Why is everybody staring at me? What do you mean, why? Because I want it, but I don't. Yes, I do, but I don't. But I don't. Ah! And internally, there's a conflict, there's a disharmony. And she's causing damage because the nature of a woman is to be a tsanua, to be modest, to be humble. But the nature of a man is not quite to be a tsanua. As a matter of fact, very differently. The male ego is much different and functions in a different way. The reason why men take offense at unsolicited advice is because it's bossing me around, pretending that I'm not competent. You see, I believe that I'm reasonably capable. I believe I'm reasonably competent, and I don't really need your advice. If I needed it, I would have asked you for it. And when a woman starts telling her husband how to drive, you know, put on the blinker, shut off the blinker, turn, madam, with all due respect, I drive 15,000 miles a year. I've been driving for 30 years. I logged 500,000 miles without you. Somehow I survived. Please don't tell me how to do it. And it hits him deep inside, and his ego is bothered, and it causes a lot of trouble in a marriage. And it is a wise woman who becomes aware of the differences between men and women, who becomes aware of the fact that her attempts to fix her husband, improve her husband, will not be well received. If she wishes to, there are ways, but this certainly isn't it. And I believe that's exactly what the Rambam's saying, that one of the criteria for a successful marriage is for a woman not to sabotage it. Treat your husband as if he's a tsar, as if he's a melech. You don't boss him around. You don't tell him what to do. You don't make suggestions that aren't asked for. Because if you do, it comes back to haunt you, because it hits him, and it hits him, and it hurts. And I don't care what level he's on, and even if he is a tremendous balmidos, and even if he's very worked out, it hurts him, and it shepherds, and it bothers him. And what it tells him in plain, simple language is his wife doesn't respect him. You see, if a guy comes over to me and says, you know, you should put your blinker on, what he's saying is, I don't trust you to drive. If a guy comes over to me and says, you know, you should do this, put your stuff in order, what he's saying to me is, I'm not capable. I need his help. And I don't take that very well. And in a marriage setting, it's a recipe for disaster. And that's one lesson to take from the Rambam's Lashon, but I think there's a lot more. But to focus on the next part, let's focus on a very interesting mitzvah. The Torah tells us that when a husband and wife gets married, the man is freed from many, many obligations. He's not allowed to go to war. He's not allowed to even help out with food or support. He is naki, he is free to stay in his house, and he's not allowed to join. Yela besu shana achas, for an entire year he should be to his house. V'simach es ishto ashelokach, and he should make happy the wife that he took. And Rashi says, make no mistake, that's what he should be doing. He should be making his wife happy. V'simach es ishto. Now, gentlemen, let's ask the obvious question. If this pasuk, this mitzvah asei doraisa, is a formula for Shalom Bayis, wouldn't you imagine there'd be much more clever ways to help Shalom Bayis? I would give him a mitzvah, go to a Shalom Bayis seminar, read all the Sfarim on Shalom Bayis, maybe work on your midos. What do you mean, v'simach es ishto? Make your wife happy, you know, you're going to have Shalom Bayis. For an entire year, focus on making your wife happy, and all of a sudden it's going to be great. What in the world does v'simach es ishto have to do with Shalom Bayis? And if you get a chance, reread the Stipler's letter. Because in that letter, the Stipler writes one line that's so powerful. And Stipler writes that the entire world of a woman, her entire tshuka, desires, aspiration is to have a husband that loves her. And if she doesn't have a husband that loves her, it's as if she's being killed. He says it's karov lepikuach nefesh. It's almost a situation where it's death, life-threatening, because her entire existence is to have and desire a husband who loves her. Women function very differently than do men. If you'd like to know on a core level, on a base level, what a woman needs in a marriage, she needs to feel cherished. She needs to feel loved. She needs to feel that her husband considers her number one priority beyond and before everything else. And if a woman feels that, there's a sense of satisfaction, there's a sense of happiness. And if she doesn't feel that, then everything else isn't going to help her, because at the core of her essence, she's empty, she's bothered, and there's something lacking. But here's the problem. How do you show a wife that she is cherished, she's esteemed, she comes before everything else? How do you show her this? And I think that's exactly what the pasuk is saying. And pay careful attention to her needs. And pay careful attention to her interests. And pay careful attention during this year to what makes her happy. And if you focus on pleasing her, it doesn't matter whether you gave her breakfast in bed or you gave her coffee. What matters is that you showed her she's cherished, she's esteemed, and that message comes through loud and clear. And if a woman knows that, she's happy. She's satisfied in the marriage. If not, becomes a very, very difficult situation for her to tolerate. And if you'd like to make your wife happy, you have to understand her needs. One of her needs is to be cherished, to know that she's esteemed, but she has other needs as well. And to understand those other needs, let's step away for a moment to a different topic. In this bathroom over here, there's a mirror. If you go to many yeshivas, many dorms, you'll see no mirrors. I was in Chofetz Chaim dorm all of my years, there were mirrors. Many yeshivas have, many don't. Many yeshivas don't have mirrors because guys shouldn't be, you know, vain. They shouldn't be sitting there brushing their hair, worrying about how they look. Other yeshivas hold as godless adam. It's not proper, it's not respectable. Yesh v'yesh, you could say either way, as long as it's a guy's dormitory. But if you find that there's a Beis Yaakov dormitory, seminary dormitory, where they don't have mirrors on the walls, grab your daughter and don't let her go near the building. Because the nature of a woman is to need to be attractive. A woman by nature has a need to be attractive, to make herself presentable. And if there's a school that teaches them not to, what they're doing is damaging the young girls because it's part of her teva, part of her nature. And I'd like to share with you, it's not something that's learned and not something that's taught in first grade or in second grade. When my son Yoel was born, he had the interesting life situation of having five mothers. You see, he had my wife, his birth mother, but he also had four older sisters right over him. So when this guy came into the world, he had five mothers. And no sooner did he come home from the hospital than his other four mothers, actually sisters, were doting over him. This was their greatest gift, a live baby doll. What could be better? And he dressed them and they put ribbons in his hair and put dresses on him and they gave him dolls to play with. And this went on and on. And as he got to be about 1.5, I started getting a little bit uncomfortable because with ribbons in his hair and wearing a dress, he looked a little strange. But I didn't have to be nervous too long because pretty close to 2 years old, someone gave him a toy truck. Gone were the dolls, gone were the dresses, gone were the ribbons. Because at the tender years of 2 years of age, this boy gravitated to trucks and toys and boy things, and never again could his sisters put ribbons in his hair, put on dresses. He was a boy all the way through. But you see, a girl at a very young age starts blossoming differently, and she enjoys and needs to feel attractive. When my daughter was 8 years old and she was getting ready for her sister's chasana, I remember her saying the words, "Boys are so dumb. They don't even know how good it feels to feel pretty." She had spent an hour. Her hairdo was being done for an hour. This was an 8-year-old girl. And if you see women dolling themselves up and getting ready, it's fun. It's enjoyable. Why? Because Hashem gave them such a nature. The nature of a woman is that she cares deeply about the way she looks, and it's very, very important to her that she be attractive. And in a marriage, obviously, it's very important for a woman to feel attractive to her husband. And it's very important that her husband look at her and she feel that he looks at her as an attractive woman. And I'd like to share with you why. Do you ever wonder why is it that Hashem put such a teva into a woman? Why is it so much a part of her? And why is it so important to her that her husband look at her as attractive? And I believe the reason for this should be pretty obvious, and that is that men have a difficult time forming attachments, forming relationships, really caring. Most men are pretty comfortable living in a cave. I remember when I was second year Beis Medrash, I was troubled by the fact that I didn't have a best friend. I don't know why I was troubled by this, but I went over to Rabbi Harris, Rosh Yeshiva then in Rochester, and I said, "I don't know, I don't have a best friend. I feel funny." Rabbi Harris said, "Best friend? Who does? Which guy do you know has a best friend?" Occasionally you have it, you know, in grade school sometimes. In high school you have a best friend, but it almost never happens. And the reason largely is because guys are very independent. And in a marriage, interestingly enough, a young husband is very happy to be roommates with certain situations set up. And if there's no real relationship and no real connection, no bonding, he's not unhappy at all. But there have to be various forces and there have to be things to pull him to her. And one of those forces is attraction. One of those forces are desires. And one of the main reasons why Hashem put beauty into a woman and the desire to be beautiful is that she should pull her husband to her. And it's a major part of the success of a marriage. And women oftentimes get very insecure. Maybe I'm not the most beautiful woman in the world. And worse than that, you know, when I was 18, maybe I was very attractive, but now I'm 28. And what's going to be when I'm 38? What's going to be when I'm 58? What about 78? I mean, if beauty and attraction and desire is a real part of the success of my marriage, that means I'm doomed because I'm heading south. You know what Rashi says? It's a Gemara, and Rashi says these words. The Gemara says, Chein isha al baila. When a woman is in front of a husband, there's a certain favor that she finds in his eyes. He finds her attractive. He finds favor in her. Says Rashi, the words, Vafilu hi mucho eres, even if she's ugly, and the Marsha explains why. The Marsha explains that this is one of the systems that Hashem uses to bond a couple together. There's desire, there's attraction, there's a whole host of things that occur to get a husband to attach himself to a woman. And it's instinctive, it's natural. But you see, here's the point. If we were hungry, we would eat. We all have nutritional needs. Let's say Hashem said you have to eat 2,500 calories a day, but there was no desire for food. I'd like to share with you, most of us would be dead after a few days, a month or two at most. And while there are nutritional needs in the human, Hashem didn't leave it at that. Hashem gave us appetite and desire so that you'll actually eat. And Hashem made food delicious so that you should enjoy it, so that you'll actually do that which you should do. You have to sleep so many hours a night. Let's say Hashem told you, you have to sleep a minimum of 6, preferably 8 hours a night. How many people would sleep? Not many. Within 3 days, a week, whatever it be, we'd all be dead. So Hashem put in this thing called exhaustion. I'm exhausted. I'm wiped out. I have to lie down. And when I lie down, it feels so enjoyable. You see, Hashem didn't just leave it to the facts. Hashem wants us to succeed. And Hashem put various forces into the human to guarantee the success of his existence and to guarantee the success of his marriage. And the reason why a woman needs to be attractive is because that's a big part of the success of a marriage. A husband needs to be drawn. He needs to be pulled in. There's desire, there's taiva, there's cycles, there are various forces that are necessary. The woman needs to feel attractive because that's one of the key ingredients, and that's a big part of what the success of marriage is about. And I believe this is also the answer for Abba Chilkia. You see, when a person uses the tools that Hashem created in the way that Hashem wants them to be used, it doesn't damage you. If you use your wife's attraction in a way to bond, to come closer, to be one, it's not building taiva. It doesn't destroy you. Quite the opposite. It's kadosh. It's holy. You're building a connection. You're building a bond. It is very difficult for men to really connect, to really feel, and to really be attached. And so Hashem gave us forces. Hashem gave us different things. And if you use them, they're holy, they're good, they're proper. But there's one more step that I think that's critical. Let's go back to the Rambam and make one more diuk that I think should be obvious. A man has to respect his wife more than himself, and he has to love her as himself. A woman has to honor his husband, Yosemidai, tremendously. But what did the Rambam leave out? He left out love in the woman. A man has to respect his wife more than himself and love her as he does himself, and a woman has to respect her husband. Well, what about the other part? What about the love that a woman should feel for a husband? And if you tell me the Rambam really holds, you don't need it, I'd like to share with you, if you find me a loveless marriage, if you find me a marriage where a wife says, my husband, yeah, whatever, did I feel anything about it? Nah, did I like it? Nah, whatever. I guarantee that is a divorce within, I don't know, a couple of months. And if not a divorce, the fighting and the shalom bayis issues are beyond description. Because if there isn't a solid base of love, of bonding, of attachment in a marriage, you are toast. And I know it's not popular to say, but if you don't understand this, you don't understand the beginnings or the inklings of a marriage. The glue of a marriage is love. in this thing called living, there are so many different issues, and a husband and wife have such different temperaments and nature, such different ways of looking at things and doing things. If there isn't a solid bond of love, they are doomed. You see, he did something, whatever it may be. If there's a bond of love, if there's a climate of love, he's a good guy with a flaw. If there isn't, he's a creep and a worthless bum, and everything he does is worthless. So why did the Rambam leave it out on the woman's side? And I'd like to share with you what may be obvious but requires understanding. What happens if a husband does his job correctly? What happens if a husband lets his wife know that she is cherished and esteemed, that she's loved and respected, and that he looks at her with eyes of absolute adoring and affection? What happens to her? What happens to her is she feels happy within herself. And by nature, a woman who's happy is dovek, clings to her zivug, to the one who's made for her. Guys have difficulty with relationships. Guys have difficulty being vulnerable, being open. They don't need one another. But women need relationships. Women need support. And Hashem made a bazug before they were born that perfectly matched. And if a woman's needs are met, she's happy, she's satisfied, and it's a no-brainer. It's automatic that she's going to love her husband. And if she doesn't love her husband, either she is a moredes or the husband is doing something wrong. And I know that I may become very unpopular from this moment on, but you guys don't pay my mortgage, so I'm going to say it anyway. If you're having a Shalom Bayis problem, I'd like to guarantee at least 80%, if not more, it's because your wife does not feel cherished, loved. She doesn't feel that she comes first. She doesn't feel that she's number one. And if you'll say to me, come on, that can't be. It's her fault because I always show honor and respect and accord and I'm always so polite and I'm always, I don't know what you're talking about. I question the truth of that. And I'll give you an example of what I mean, and it's, you know, only because it's one example and it's an extreme, but Rav Aaron Feldman in his book, in his Sefer, has an interesting story. He says that someone came to him, a man was having a lot of Shalom Bayis problems, and he came to Rav Aaron Feldman for advice. And so sat down. Rav Aaron Feldman asked him, so tell me, how's your communication? And it's communication? That's not a problem whatsoever. We're always talking, and it's always very meaningful. And so he asked, tell me, what do you mean? So the man said, well, listen, as soon as I come home from work, we sit down. I waste no time with small talk. I get right down to the brass tacks. I show her exactly what she did wrong, how she could improve it. I show her step by step exactly how she could be better. Our communication couldn't be better. Smart guy, right? Okay. So it's obvious to us on the outside, but let me share with you what she on the inside feels. She feels attacked, degraded, debased. My husband, the one who's supposed to support me, supposed to love me, is critical. I don't do this well enough, and this isn't good enough, and that's not good enough, and this is not good enough, and he's have to do it this way and this way. And if I have a word of advice to women, it's don't fix your husband. And if I have a word of advice for men, it's don't criticize your wife. But come on, she bounced the check again. If I don't tell her, how's she going to know? Okay, first of all, you told her 9,999 times already. You're telling her 10,000 times, now she's going to get it? But more than that, you have to listen very carefully to what your words say. If your words are critical, if your words are difficult to bear on the receiving end, what your wife hears more loudly than anything else is she's not accepted, she's not esteemed, she's not held of, she sure isn't cherished. And those words are very, very damaging, very, very hurtful. And I guarantee at some point, if you find that you're having a Shalom Bayis problem, it is the woman who's not feeling cherished. And how do I know that? Because almost every guy is very happily married without a relationship. Who demands, who's toveya the relationship? Who demands the connection? It's the woman. She's the one who needs it. She's the one who seeks it out. And she's the one who's not satisfied when there's not a bonding and a connection. And if you wonder why it is that Hashem made a need in a woman to be attractive to her husband, It's to draw her husband in. And if you wonder why it is that Hashem made a need in a woman to have relationships, it's because she is the Akeres Abayis. And her need to feel attached and her need to feel cherished is because she has a need to feel one with you. She has an emotional need for this. If it's met, she's happy, she's satisfied, and you'll have a loving wife. And if not, oyvei and oyvei. Now, I'm not here to tell you that all Shalom Bayis problems are the men. I've dealt with quite a number of issues where it's the women who are off their rockers, excuse my vernacular. But I am telling you that most of the time, most of the issues can be cured if a husband conveys one single message to his wife. You are not just accepted. I have no criticism whatsoever. What you do, as you do, is perfect. You are perfect. I guarantee it will change the Shalom Bayis radically. And the only reason why you can't hear what I'm saying is because you have a male ego. I'm not going to admit that she's right. She's wrong, and I'm right. I've been telling her all along. And every single time I tell her and tell her and tell her, and it's about time that she admitted it. You know what the Peleoid says? The Peleoid says, isn't it astonishing? A guy owns a butcher shop, and there's a huge shipment of meat that comes in, and it's a Yoredei Shaila, and he brings it to the Rav, and the Rav says it's treif. He gives it up. He loses tens of thousands of dollars happily. Not a problem whatsoever. But the minute there's a fight between him and his neighbor over two pennies, I'll fight him to the last penny. I'll fight. What a fellow. And tens of thousands of dollars a minute ago, you were mavata like it's nothing. Now two pennies and you're all bent out of shape. Explains to Peleoitz, it's one reason. It's nothing to do with the money. It has to do with me against you. And what he calls avas and itzachon, the desire to win, to always be right. I have never seen it. I have never once seen it. A couple comes into my office and they say, yes, it's true. It's his fault. Yes, we both agree. No, we both agree it's her fault. Yes, we both agree. Never once. Ask marriage therapists, ask Rabbanim, have they ever seen a couple that walk into someone's office and say, yes, it's all my fault. Yes, we both agree it's all my fault. It's his fault, her fault. Finger pointing, and you can't ever get to the beginning. Would you like to understand what Shalom Bayis issues are about? When I was a little boy, I remember going into my mother, Alei Shalom's bedroom. She had a dresser over here with a mirror, and on the wall behind me was a mirror. And I was a little guy, and I remember looking into this mirror on the dresser, and it was opposing the mirror on the wall. And I saw me, and then I saw me reflected, and me reflected, and me reflected, and me reflected. And I remember looking for a long, long time to find the last me. Where is he? And I could never find the last me. Just listen to a couple bickering. You said, he said, well, yesterday, it was the day before, and then you did that, and you did that. Oh, my goodness. Where does it begin? Where does it end? And the answer is never. And the reason is because it has nothing to do with the issues that they're arguing about. I don't think you'll ever find that you have a fight with your wife over an issue. You know why? Because issues, we can find a solution. My way, your way, somewhere in the middle. The issue is never the problem. Do you know that 70% of marriages have an irreconcilable difference? Irreconcilable difference means a difference that cannot be poshet. He wants to live in San Diego, and she wants to live in New York City. When we live in Chicago in the middle, he's got allergies, so he has to live in this place, and she's very sensitive to the cold. That's irreconcilable. There's no way to reconcile that. 70% of marriages have some major big deal issue that have no solution, and yet they remain married. And more than that, social scientists measure these things. They say that 33%, about a third of arguments between husband and wife issues have no reconciliation. There is no way. Even the small ones, there's no pshara. And yet, amazingly, some couples are very happily married and some fight tooth and nail like cats and dogs. And I'd like to share with you that it has nothing to do with the issues because two reasonable people can find a solution. Your way, my way, somewhere in the middle. There's never a problem with two intelligent, reasonable people solving an issue. But that's the point. It's never about the issue. It's about the I. You know what you did to me? You know what those words said to me? And whether it be he or she, whether it be his ego or her vulnerability, the words that are exchanged are only relevant vis-a-vis the harm and the hurt that they feel. And when you begin studying the human, and you begin studying a relationship, and you begin understanding that it is vast, it is complex, and it's very, very difficult to piece together. And I think the Rambam's formula is exactly that. It's a perfect formula if you're willing and able to be open-minded and understand things. But to be honest with you folks, most of us aren't. What happens the first time you found your wife crying for no good reason? Right? You came home and she was crying for no good reason. So the first time, maybe you chalk it up. Well, that's women. It's okay. And second time, maybe. But the third time, you knew it. She's a crybaby. She's just a crybaby. She's just got a problem. Right? Okay, here, watch this one. A guy comes home, he's married for 6 months, and he married an intelligent, put-together young woman, and he's very happily married, and he's very favorably impressed with her. He comes home one day, opens the door, and he sees her standing on the chair. What? And he looks. What? Cockroach. Okay, and he goes over, steps on a cockroach, and says to himself, oh, man, she's, that's interesting. Sure pegged her wrong. Whoa. And what he just did was make the first major mistake of his marriage. Why? When my kids were little, Shalom Ari was about, he was 2 years old, and his older sister, whenever there was a bug, said, Shalmari, get the bug. And Shalmari would play with it and squish it and squash it because two-year-old boys aren't afraid of bugs. Guys aren't afraid of bugs, but girls are. And when she's standing up on the chair, you know what she's experiencing? Terror. She's petrified. The equivalent to you being in a room and a wild dog, a pit bull, is there. You'd be scared out of your wits. That's what she's experiencing. But you, tough guy that you are, look at her up on the chair, and you go, woman, what is wrong with you? Oh, man. And what she hears in very loud terms is, this guy is a creep. He's watching me in abject terror, and not only doesn't he feel my pain, he makes fun of me. He mocks me. He discards my feelings. Okay, you'll say, not a big deal, right? But let's play it out. What happens 2 weeks later? He's in yeshiva, he's steiging, he's in the middle of a tosis, he's deep in it. And someone says his wife calls. The guy's a masbid, doesn't even take a cell phone into the base medrash, but his wife called somebody else. This guy comes over. Your wife needs you home right away. Oh, I fail right away. Oh, gets in the car, drives home, oh, opens the door. Yes, dear, what? And it's there. What? There. Oh, no. And she's pointing to another cockroach, two of them. Oh, my God. Crunch, crunch. This is what you call me home for? This is what I had to stop learning for? I had to get in a car, stop learning, and drive because of stupid cockroaches? Goodbye, I'll see you later. And he storms out the door. And he's right. And he's a normal guy. And he's also a fool. Because what does she hear? What a creep. I'm sitting here so afraid. I'm actually, my husband's learning. There's nothing that I'd want more. The only reason I'm working is so he could learn. But I'm so afraid that I have to call him back. And not only doesn't he understand how much I'm shaking in fear, he makes fun of me, and he abuses me, and he mocks me. And for the fun of it, let's take it one more step. She gets it. The only way she's going to survive this marriage is if she gets tough. So she learns to take out the can of Raid herself, and she learns how to spray it, and she gets real good. And after a month of never once bothering him, he was learning and steiging. She says, dear, do you realize what has happened? No. For an entire month, I didn't bother you. I learned how to use the Raid myself, and I overcame the... Baruch Hashem, you finally got normal. Good. Uh-huh. She worked. She changed. She made a tremendous roshim in herself. And what he said was, I don't care. And dismissiveness, just like whatever, is one of the greatest poisons in a marriage. And it surfaces in so many different ways. My way or your way, should we paint the walls blue or green? Everyone knows that green is not a color for walls. What are you? Come on, are you kidding me? And if I would tell you how many times men or women take the attitude of my way is the right way and they get dismissive as if to say your way is irrelevant and you have no right to an opinion, and it is one of the most damaging, destructive things in a marriage. John Gottman is a psychologist, and he studies marriages, but he studies them very carefully. He puts a couple in chairs, and he puts monitors on their wrists, on their sweat glands. He videotapes every single conversation, but he doesn't just videotape. He has body readings from temperature, from sweat production, heart rate. He videotapes the conversations, and afterwards he goes over it with the couple. And he's managed to get down to a science. And he says that he can predict divorce with a 92% accuracy. The couple that are in the chairs, he tells them to talk about an issue that they're dealing with. And 92% of the time, he could tell you that within a year or less, whether they'll be divorced or not. And how does he do it? He says it's very simple. All he's really looking for is contempt. If she rolls her eyes often enough, and there you go again. If he gives one of his, enough of those, and he knows it's history. Because contempt is the opposite of attachment, of bonding, of love. And if you're not careful, I almost guarantee that you're going to show those emotions, those signs often in your marriage. And it's men about women, women about men, and only because this is, we're more men here than women, let's touch on the issues that we men often miss on. Oiv is ishto kegufo, machab de yosem igufo, that was the first part of the Rambam. Why is it that a man has to honor his wife more than himself? I understand a woman, she has to treat her husband with more honor than himself because he's got a male ego, sunburn on the ego, and she had better bow down to him, treat him with honor, because if she critiques him, if she criticizes him, it's going to be a barb. He likes to feel capable. He doesn't like to feel that he's not accepted. Okay, I got that. But why does a husband have to treat his wife with more honor than himself? He's got the big ego. If it's satisfactory to him, obviously it's surely good enough for her. It'd be good enough, just like he loves her like himself, surely it would be good enough to treat her with the same honor as he does himself. And says Rashi, the reason why, because embarrassment to a woman is more painful. You see, women aren't crybabies. Women feel emotions far more intensely than do men. And the reason why Chazal say you have to be more careful with her honor than yours is because if you show up late to a wedding, you'll be a little bit embarrassed, but she'll be mortified. And if something happens and you bounce a check, you'll be beat red. She'll be ready to find a hole in the ground to crawl into. And women feel emotions to a much greater extent. They feel a greater array of emotions. They feel them more intensely on the highs and the lows. And if you would like to be successfully married, I think you have to be very, very aware of that. How many times have you come home, if you are married or if you're not married, put this into perspective, it'll be coming soon, and your wife is losing it. And women do that, whether it be about the finances or about the kids or about schooling, and she's losing it. And what do? You very politely, very nicely pull out the Nike ad. Come on, just get it together. Just do it. Come on, enough. Let's go. Come on, listen. We're going to be all right. We'll make ends meet. Come on, honey, listen, with all the respect, come on. We're not getting evicted. We're not going to lose our house. Our kids are going to, come on, stop it, please. Come on, get it together. And even if the guy doesn't buy into the Nike, just do it routine, and he politely and gently explains to her why her feelings are unbased. Isn't that sane, rational, normal, good husband to do? Yeah, and dangerous. Why? Because if she's a woman and she really feels overwhelmed and she really feels that the kids are so out of control that it's unbelievable, when you say to her, come on, you're exaggerating now, you're not giving her solace. What you're saying to her is you're not with her, and her feelings aren't valid. And as strange as it sounds to a man, what you're saying to her is, I don't accept you, I'm not with you, I'm against you. And for the life of them, guys can't figure out why women not only don't take those words of wisdom, they get all upset and all puffy and they get all angry. And I believe the two most important words that a couple must learn to say on a regular basis, And if you say these words, your marriage can be successful. But if you don't say these words, I doubt your marriage is going to be successful. And those two words are not, I love you. Actually, those are three words. Those you should say 10,000s of times. And if you're not sure that I'm right, read Rabbi Kager's letter. When his wife passed away, and Reb Shlomo Eger, his son, writes in his tshuvas that his father was given, someone wanted to read a shidduch to Rabbi Kager. It was apparently long enough after the death of his wife that it was appropriate. And Reb Shlomo Eger writes down that his father said, how could I even think of it? This was a woman with whom I shared my life, my every desire, my every secret. She was with me in everything. Since she died, I could barely eat. I could barely drink. My stomach doesn't hold down food. I could barely say a bracha chrona. I can't daven without losing myself. I can barely learn. You want me to discard her and take another? And the man was a gavra rabba. The man was one of the gdolei achronim, but the man was bonded and attached and had a real marriage. So if you would like to be successfully married, saying I love you is a no-brainer thousands and thousands and thousands of times. But those aren't the secret words. Even the words I'm sorry, which you had better be ready to say thousands and thousands and thousands of times, also aren't the secret words. Would you like to know what the two words are? I'll share with you what I believe they are. In almost all scientific inquiry, in almost every scientific discovery was not preceded by the words, Eureka, I've discovered it. Almost every discovery in science was preceded with the words, that's strange. A scientist had crawled into one given area, he understood it, and something didn't add up. There was something that didn't make sense. And what he did was he dug in and finally uncovered. Wow! And it's not the word Eureka that precedes all scientific discoveries. It's the words, that's strange. Because then he digs in and begins to understand what he didn't understand before, and then he comes to new knowledge. And if you would like to be successfully married, I'd like to teach you those two words. That's strange. And when your wife does something that really doesn't make sense, she really, any guy that you would say, bring it to, would tell you it's absurd, it's crazy, it just doesn't make sense. What you have to train your tongue to do is say the words, that's strange. Because what it means is one of two things. Either you married a card-carrying nut, she's deranged, she's insane, put her in the loony bin, or more likely, there's something else going on. There's a different emotionality, different needs, different things. And if you train your tongue to say the words, that's strange, and then try to figure out what it is that she needs, what it is that bothered her, you can then be a husband, you could be a support, you could be with her. And women have to figure this out also, because their husbands do the strangest things. The young Kala married for 6 months can't figure out for the life of her why her husband would leave Matzah Shabbos, go play ball, stays out 2 hours later than and didn't even call. How could he do that? How could he? And she's so broken. And she doesn't understand that guys by nature are independent. And for a guy to have to call his wife, especially in the beginning of his marriage, requires some almost fitas yetzer, because when I have a boss, I have to answer, what am I, my mother, I have to tell you everywhere I go, every place, and I come back to. And it's difficult in the beginning years. And a woman has to learn to say the words, that's strange. And if a husband trains himself to say the words, that's strange, and a woman does, they begin discovering each other, and they begin discovering that they work with very different emotions, and very different mindsets. They have so little connection one to the other, that they require a lot of work to bring themselves closer. Hashem created this institution called marriage, and Hashem wants it to succeed. And I think what this Gemara is sharing with us is Abba Chilkia used a tool. Attraction is something that Hashem put into the human race. Desire, romantic attraction, and looking at your wife with a sense of appreciation is an important part of a marriage. The reason why it's an important part of a marriage is because men typically need more to pull them. Women, if they're satisfied in the marriage, if they're happy, typically automatic is to them the sense of love and devotion. For a man, it's much more difficult, and it usually takes a lot more time. If you study this institution called marriage, study your wife, and learn some tolerance, you don't get dismissive, you don't have the attitude of she's crazy and hyper and just emotional crybaby. You start trying to understand why she reacts that way, and you start developing a certain understanding. You're able to offer what a husband has to offer, which is support, and a wife studies a husband, husband studies wife, and they keep the Rambam's formula, and life is beautiful. He respects her more than himself and loves her as himself, and she respects him, yosir midai, and they have a beautiful marriage. And I want to close with one last thought. It's kind of what I call the sequel to the story. Everyone knows the famous story, but I just recently heard the sequel to it, and it's astonishing. A young man went to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach to ask him for advice. He was a chassan, and he wanted to ask advice because he was getting married soon nearby. Now, everyone knows the famous story that Rav Shlomo Zalman, at the levaya of his wife, got up and said the words that Minog Yisrael is to ask Mechila at the levaya because it's the last time you can ask from a person, but I'm not going to ask Mechila from my wife because in all of our married years, there is nothing that I have to ask Mechila from for her. There's nothing that she did and had to ask Mechila for me. And those are the famous words. So anyway, this young man, because he was getting married, decided to ask who else but Rav Shlomo Zalman for advice. So he goes to Rav Shlomo Zalman and they made an appointment. And they sat down, and Rav Shlomo Zalman gave him some etzah, some advice, how to be happily married, etc. Very nice. The young man got married, and maybe 6 months after his wedding, he's at a wedding or somewhere, and he meets again Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. And Rav Shlomo Zalman says to him, "Nu, how's married life?" The fellow says, "Mei menuchos, waters of tranquility." Oh, perfect. Rav Shlomo Zalman says something like, "You married? How's your marriage?" May menuchos, mamish, perfect, perfect. You really married? And the fellow realized that something was going on here. He said, but Rishiva, didn't Rishiva at the husband for his own wife say there's nothing to ask Mechila for? Wasn't that May menuchos, perfect marriage? Shlomo Zalman said to him, don't you understand? It's impossible for two human beings not to have different opinions. It's impossible for two human beings not to have different ways of looking at things, different desires, and different interests. The reason why I didn't ask Mechila is because I never spoke in a way to my wife that required Mechila. But of course, there were many issues, many things. There can't be a marriage that doesn't have it. But each of us spoke to one the other with respect in such a way that it never came to words that required Mechila. And I believe the rest of the story is even more profound than that part of the story. Understanding that Shalom Bayis is something that requires work, that it's something that requires vigilant work, and requires tremendous Siyata Deshmaya. You have to work on it, you have to daven. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu grant us the wisdom, the ability to put this into practice.